to the Slow Dive podcast, where we explore impact, community, and storytelling. Today, we're diving into a conversation with Felix Mack, a filmmaker originally from Scotland whose work celebrates shared joy and the power of community. Felix is an alumnus of the Warner Brothers Discovery Early Career Bootcamp and the Film North Inclusive and Socially Conscious Filmmaking Lab. His films have been showcased at renowned festivals nationwide, including Baby Teeth, 29 Queer, and Out on Film. Recently, he's been making waves with projects like Willa Justice, Drag Queen Private Eye, a spy comedy short featuring Emmy nominee Scott Turner Schofield, and Roughing It, starring Emmy nominee Aaron Hayes. Beyond the screen, Felix is also a storyteller with the knack for unforgettable adventures. Ask him about that time he lived in a tree. Join us as we dive deep into Felix's creative journey, his passion for inclusive storytelling, and what it means to build connection through film. Hello, Felix.
Hello. How are you doing? Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy you're here too. Nice. All right, well, we're going to go straight into the icebreakers, Felix. So what was the first concert you ever attended?
Oh, okay. System of a Down in the Barrowlands in Glasgow. And my friend like abandoned me halfway to make out with some dude in the mosh pit.
That's an experience.
Uh-huh. It was a good time.
Oh my gosh. I remember them. What happened to them? I mean, now I have to go visit their music. Cool. Okay. What are you reading right now?
Oof. Okay. Several things. I'm finishing up a book about producing, which is very out of date, but I'm enjoying it. And I'm also reading Lou Sullivan's Diaries. For those who don't know, Lou Sullivan was a pioneer transgender man who lived with AIDS, unfortunately died of that, but he is heralded as a pioneer within the transgender community.
Oh, cool. We will add that to your show guide. Okay, Felix, what was your first job?
My high school had another school attached to it, which was for people with learning difficulties. And I would do an after school session there. So after school, I would go in the bus with some people from that school, and we would do like an after school session where it was a lot of like art and playing Bop It, actually, art and Bop It. but it was really rewarding. It was really rewarding. So.
Wow, Bop It. Is that the one with the hippos? Is it? That's not the one with the hippos, is it?
No, it's like you hold it in your hand.
Hippos.
Oh, it's like twist it, push it, but you know, you have to do it in time or else it freaks out at you. Yeah.
That's intense. I don't think I can pull it off. Okay, if you weren't a producer or you weren't in entertainment, what other field would you be in?
Well, I've tried a lot of fields, and this is the one thing that has actually felt like I want to do it. Before this, the thing that stuck was I was like an activist for a long time. So I was doing kind of environmental activism, and then I moved into like queer social justice stuff. So it's kind of always been something that's centered in community unity. So I guess if it wasn't in film, then it would be finding another way to bring people together, maybe in a common space or some sort of advocacy, I think.
Yeah, excellent. I love that. Now, we're going to go to your next segment, which is, I titled it very basically, but I know it's not basic. I said, UK to US. can I just tell you, Scottish shortbreads are legit. And to use the young vernacular, fire. I'm telling you, like this time, and I am being South Asian, I absolutely adore the Scottish shortbreads with chai. Is that as popular in Scotland as it is? I mean, I know it's like a Scottish thing, but like, do people like really enjoy it as much as we love enjoying it here during the season?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things we're definitely proud of. and you know, something that's funny for me as a Scot in America is people obviously, I mean, we're all related, right? So I get a lot of people who are like, I have Scottish ancestry, and people are really interested in the tradition and the culture and definitely the food. But so often I'm like, that's the wrong brand. You know, like we all know our, like, we're like, if you're Scottish, you're like, these are the top brands, and anything else is like not worth your time. So as soon as someone's like, oh, I'm getting shortbread, I'm like, is it Walker's?
Yeah, I get
You know,
Whoppers. Is it
you
is
know,
Whoppers?
okay,
Oh, okay, I get
that's
Whoppers.
legit. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's unless
Those
it's
are
that.
dangerous.
Yeah.
They're so good. Okay, well that's good 'cause you know that like I mean we're here obviously from Scotland to Southern California, different seasons, different vibe, but like still like for me around this time the holidays are coming. That's like one of the things I like. I'm like I know I'm not wearing any sweaters or sweats or blankets, but like I'll still enjoy and indulge in a shortbread.
Yeah, you need to get your
So
butter up for sure. You need to make sure you're having enough butter.
I
Yeah,
thought you were gonna get your butt up. I was like, no, that happens with the butter. That just generally
yeah.
expands, right? Like, no, it's true. You're right. Like, that's horrible. Cut that out. That sounds awful. But the butter part, yes, butter is good. The other part, edit that out. So, anyways, I had to bring that in because I've only been to Scotland once in my life, and I find the drippy weather very conducive to writing and. So many great writers come from that region of the world. So it's just I had to just bring that into our episode.
Yeah,
So
for
tell me
sure.
something. What brought you to America?
My husband, actually, we met in Edinburgh in 2019 at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which, if anyone doesn't know what that is, you have to experience it at least one time in your life. It's an international festival. It started as a theater festival, and then it became the Fringe. It basically eclipsed that, and so it's just the population in Edinburgh basically trebles for the entire month of August. You cannot move for there being a free comedy show or some sort of really wacky drama going on. There's people in the streets. It's amazing. I was working on a show. He was working on a show, and we just kind of had this month-long romance, and then after that it was like, well, where are we gonna be? And it's too cold for him over there, you know. So we were like, okay, well, let's try me coming over here. And yeah, now I've been here since 21, so it's like 3 years, and going over 3 years now. And yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. So
Now, is your husband also Scottish or is he American?
he's from the Bay Area,
Oh,
and
okay.
he works in theater. Yeah.
Ah, okay. So that's really cool. So, okay, so it was both of you guys decided to come to America and relocate here and everything. And so were you in the film community in the scene prior to that, or did you discover that upon visiting Great old Hollywood.
A little bit of both. I used to be part of a queer film festival in the north of England, in Leeds. Shout out to Leeds Queer Film Festival. So I would kind of help out with some of their programming there, because they were always wanting to make sure that people from communities that were being showcased were also being able to act, like, look at what was happening being programmed ahead of time. So I'd help out there. And then when I came over here, it was like this revelation, like, you can actually make money, you can like make a livable career in the arts, which, like, of course there are people doing that in the UK, but it feels a lot more like harder to access. And I think that's also part of this kind of like American dream narrative, right? Like, we have this narrative that it's like you can kind of just fall over yourself in the street into an opportunity, and that doesn't exist in the UK. Like, I know the American dream has changed. Some people say it doesn't exist anymore, but like, yeah, the way that you kind of experience America as an immigrant or someone who is relocating, or however you want to call it, is very different. And I think, yeah, I definitely have experienced that, where I'm like, there's an opportunity over here that I've never would have imagined, you know? So yeah, it felt possible. And I started as a writer. I wrote, I started working on a queer and trans holiday script, because I saw Happy Season and I was like, hang on a second, I didn't realize that gay people were allowed to be in these films. So thank you for that, Clea Duvall. And I was like, this is great. We're punching into this genre, but like, this doesn't look anything like my experience. And so I really wanted to go with that. And then from there, I just started meeting so many amazing creatives over here and just kind of fell into a producer role on Wheel of Justice. From there, it's just been like, yeah, falling in love with producing, falling in love with filmmaking, and making a lot of community through that, which feels really exciting.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into Wheel of Justice, drag queen Private Eye in the next segment. But so you were saying just more opportunities for filmmakers and creatives here than in UK or in Scotland specifically. And now you'll also be moving again, maybe?
Yeah, so we are going to go to San Francisco at some point next year. Basically, my husband works over there, so it's like so much easier. And we also just have like our chosen family is in the Bay Area, mm-hmm. so it feels really nice to be close to them. And especially, you know, politically, I think, you know, the next however many years, we want to be with our queer family. So, yeah.
Yeah. So will you be, you're a producer, you're a screenwriter, you're a creative. So will you, you have some projects in the works lined up for San Francisco?
Yeah. So I'm still going to be working on Willa. I have the short Roughing It is going into festivals at the moment. So we're like doing all of our submitting. So those are two projects that I'm just still on. Yeah. We're working towards the Willa feature. And I'm also at the very beginnings of a documentary about the history of transgender community building. And I feel like there's just so much to access in the Bay Area around that. There is an archive there that is really helpful. There's just, everyone knows San Francisco is a really big hub of queer history. So I'm really excited to dive in on that front.
That's cool. And you're already prepared for the weather. Like, mentally you're already prepared because, you know, like you're from Scotland, so it's not going to be too difficult to adjust. It'll be like, hey, I'm back home. So that's great. Okay. So second segment is community and creativity. So you are a trans filmmaker, a filmmaker and producer. Where do you think there is a misunderstanding or misrepresentation of the trans community amongst the general public? Because I think we kind of talked about it. People have there's some rhetoric out there that's like, oh gosh, you know, drag queens and these spaces are not for this. And so we kind of talked about it briefly. Yeah. Feel free to share what you want. I definitely want to give you the space to talk about it because I feel like, you made some important points.
Yeah, for sure. I think I can go on the drag front first, because drag is definitely part of the trans community. It's also like a big part of the wider like queer community at large as well. There is obviously this misconception that that drag queens are, you know, here to radicalize your kids or are in some way performing things of an adult nature near children. That's not what's happening. I can tell you as a gay person, I don't really want any kids to be around when I'm having fun at night. As I think most people who have kids also don't, you know, like we go to a gay bar to see a drag show, like that's leave your kids at home. Like gay people have kids too. They're not going to bring their kids to that because we want to have a nice time without them. So the events that happen that are for kids are usually like drag queen story hour, you know, and it's like, okay, so somebody who's dressed in something really fabulous and is really has some great comic timing is going to read your kid some stories, you know? And so this argument that we're like, or that drag in general is in some way corrupting kids, it really comes from this place of like, you're afraid to allow your kids to see, you know, quote unquote, like a man in a dress, you know? And that is not about corruption. That's about what you think that means and what it stands for. And it absolutely comes from a place of like homophobia, because nobody is taking their kids to a pantomime and being like, oh, there's drag here, we think that's corrupting our youth. Like pantomimes have been a huge deal, specifically in the UK forever, you know. Nobody's watching Mrs. Doubtfire and screaming that it's going to corrupt the youth, because it's okay when straight people do that, right? So like the real thing is we're worried our kids are going to be gay, and like, yeah, they might be, and if they are, you probably want to be nice to them, because when you're not, you don't have a relationship anymore. So it's less about, you know, people are corrupting our youth, and more about what is your relationship to your kids?
Yeah, no, you made a very important point, Felix, because I think that is a misrepresentation. Like, in general, there are spaces that are just for adults, like go to a bar, go to a lounge, go to a certain concert. Yeah, kids are not there and they shouldn't be there regardless, right? Like,
yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, so that jumbling of that, I think that was important because that's brought up a lot of times in the narrative out there. So I was like, well, let me just ask Felix, you know, his thoughts, because I think it's important to hear from someone who is trans, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And just to go further into like actual trans specific things, I think the main kind of rhetoric right now that's really damaging is around access to healthcare. So I can tell you unequivocally that there are not kids accessing healthcare. The only kind of healthcare that any kind of trans kid is accessing is hormone blockers. And that's a pause that doesn't do anything to like change the body, quote unquote, irreparably. You know, nobody is giving kids surgery. Nobody is giving kids hormones. Like that is just not something that exists at all. I can tell you that like as an adult, it took me several years to access the healthcare that I needed, you know? And I think that that's some people seem to think you just walk into a doctor's office and they're like, sure, what do you want? And it's like, even with informed consent in, you know, parts of North America, that's not a thing, you know, it's a really big weighted decision that doctors don't take lightly. And there's a lot of roadblocks in the way for that. It's, I know people, especially in the UK, who've been on waiting lists for years. You know, people die on those waiting lists because they can't access what they need. So the reverse of what people think is actually what's happening. And I think that sometimes we see people in the media who have more monetary access to things. The more money you have, the quicker you're going to be able to access healthcare or anything that costs money, right? But that doesn't mean that that's what's happening for most people across the board. So yeah, I just think it's important to like reiterate that.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you for sharing that. Because I definitely am not an expert on this, but I know there's a lot of controversy and sensitivity. I'm not a parent, so I'm not going to speak on any parent's behalf. I don't have children. So that's not a space that I feel equipped to speak on behalf of. But given that there is rhetoric out there, I think, if there's, I guess, consent, appropriate guardianship and care to the matter, to the individuals, especially children. The parents have that relationship with the doctors, and that's a decision they make. I don't know. I don't speak for that. But thank you for illuminating your viewpoint, because I think that's important, right? So especially for, because I know Los Angeles, one of the things about Los Angeles and maybe probably on the West Coast in general, it is a very open and more inclusive and accepting community of people, diversity and all, which is wonderful. And we're all in this bubble. But for people outside of Los Angeles who perhaps may have not met someone from the trans community, what are some misconceptions or what are some like things that like, I guess, like, because, you know, it's so easy to otherize or vilify what people are unfamiliar with, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of, have you had to deal with that outside of that? And I mean, I'm just making a very ignorant question, but I want to understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you had that experience, Felix? Like,
yeah,
you know?
Because people don't understand what it could possibly feel like to be trans when they're not. I think there's this misunderstanding that it's like, oh, it's just that you're like unwell, you know? And it's like, okay, well, if you want to treat it like that, if we want to call it like a medical condition, which some people have historically, you know, then let us have access to the treatment that has been scientifically proven to work, you know? So I think there's definitely this misunderstanding that what people who are, in some people's views, unwell need is to be like, you know, straightened out. And we know that people who go through any kind of conversion therapy are likely to, you know, if they manage to survive that, which many people don't, many people commit suicide, then they don't live happy lives. They, you know, they're burdened with this knowledge of who they are inside that they're holding down. And so I think that there's this misalignment. Well, it's a big distrusting of actual science one, but it's also this thing of like, we can fix you. And it's like, well, who are you? No, you can't. Like, my doctor, who's studied for many years, is able to give me treatment that can alleviate the pain that I feel in this world, because I feel misaligned. Not that every trans person accesses healthcare or is able to access healthcare, but for those of us who do, and that's where the majority of the kind of advocacy is needed in this moment, due to all of the legislation that is trying to be passed internationally, is like, just listen to doctors, listen to science. Like, I think it's really kind of fascinating in a weird way that there's so many people who don't know anything about the topic that they're talking about, and yet they will talk with so much conviction. And what I would say is, like, can you just actually listen to a trans person? Like, here's a challenge. Can you sit in a conversation with a trans person and allow them to tell you what their life is like and who they are without interrupting for however long that conversation takes? And then, like, just that, like, step one, just do that. Just listen to a transgender person, you know? I spent a lot of time being very, like, kind of angry at a lot of people and pushing people away and not wanting to engage with some of the more difficult conversations. And now that I, you know, I've been living as male for like over a decade now, it's much easier for me to have those kind of conversations. But that doesn't mean that most people who are trans want to have those conversations. A lot of us just want to be left alone to live our lives and are not seeking to take on an advocacy or educational role. That's something I'm happy to do when people are willing to have an actual conversation and engage. Like, you know, like what you just said, maybe I'm asking an ignorant question. You're not in this instance, but the fact that you are willing to be wrong, the fact that you're willing to allow this to be an equal conversation, is really all that most of us want when we're engaging with this topic on a kind of one-to-one basis, you know?
Yeah, no, thank you, Felix, because I feel like, and this otherizing and vilifying that, whatever we're unfamiliar with, whether it's trans community or it's anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or any other, if you don't know someone and you don't listen and just hold space to understand that, then it is, you can fall a victim to the rhetoric and the hate and the discrimination. And I, like I said, one of the goals of our podcast is, like, you know, just share the space and we just get a better understanding. Because I feel like all of us are in a global family anyways. We're all on the same blue marble called Earth. And the more we know each other, the less divisive we are. We just realize at the end of the day, we're all just human. But yes, we have our unique lived in experiences, and we should have empathy, or at least some understanding and respect for one another. Even if we don't, maybe if there is, like, some, for some reason you don't understand it fully, but there's still respect, right? Like, it's like, okay, I don't get it 100%, but, you know, as a human, we all deserve this equal amount of respect and understanding. So no, I hope I'm not being redundant, but I was like, well, what kind of questions can I ask Felix? Because I really I definitely that's the goal with this podcast, is just to have these, I guess, vulnerable, maybe candid conversations, but definitely something where we're all reflecting and learning from one another. So I really appreciate you being open to that.
I'm always open to that.
Sometimes I'm like, let me just ask the dumb question. Is that okay? Okay, so moving to another intrusive question. aside from the ownership of stories and lived experiences, what do you think about writing and producing stories outside of one's experience? Like, for example, because that's the thing, like, and to give you a little bit more context, which you probably already, I see that smile, I'm like, you know what I'm talking about. It's like, who can tell what stories?
Okay, so I'm probably gonna, not everyone's gonna agree with this. And I definitely spent a lot of time in the world where, you know, I was like, Only trans people can tell trans stories. And I don't believe that anymore, which I know is controversial.
Why is that controversial? Can I ask?
So the problem is, queer people in general are maybe like 20 years behind in terms of owning our own stories, specifically in Hollywood and beyond, right? If you look at what stories are being told now, they are actually a lot of the time out of step with the community at large. Okay, so I loved the film Bros.
It came out a couple of years ago, right?
It's that, yeah,
it's Billy
Eichner. Yeah, yeah. And this is an example of a queer person telling a queer story. But I highlight it for the point that the queer community did not rally behind this movie at all, you know? And it's because the kinds of like diversity, the kinds of story that the queer community is ready for far advances on what studios will fund right now, basically. And that obviously with the current political climate has vastly decreased recently as well. So when I see something like Bros, I know that I've never seen a gay romance like in a rom-com on a theatrical release. That hasn't happened in my lifetime. However, the community at large is like, we've seen two cis gay white guys making out before. You know, we've seen that a lot. Where are, you know, this transer story, or like, where's the bisexual story, or why is this story so white, et cetera, et cetera. There's just so much more that we are ready for. Again, I love that movie. Very sad that the community didn't see what I saw, but that's the other thing, right? We're not a monolith. So
yeah.
I use that just to say where we are in time is the problem. So I actually came from, last night I went to see Emilia Perez for the third time. Perez is my, I'm obsessed with it. And that is very out of step with the trans community at large. I don't know if you saw, actually posted a takedown article, which I am kind of upset about, to be honest. I understand, right? I'm not going to say I don't understand. I've seen this film three times. I'm a trans person who's been in community for many years. I understand. I get what scares people. However, there are a lot of trans people who this resonates with. There's a trans woman at the center of this film who has been involved in creating that film, collaborating very closely with the director. And I feel very uncomfortable about attempts to basically get in the way of her having an Oscar nomination. I don't understand why that's happening.
I've heard great things about it from like everybody, like whether they're in the community or not, like in general. So I wasn't even aware of that at all.
Yes.
Is that recent?
Yes. So because there is
Don't give me a spoiler though.
I won't spoil it. But okay. The crux of the problem is that there is a white cis, I think straight, I don't know, man at the heart of this. And people are like, that's not your story. And it's not his story. But from my point of view, he has way more access than any trans person does. So he's able to make a story at this level that can propel into, and he's made, like, he's hiring a trans woman to play herself. Like, there's never been a trans person who's been nominated for a role where they play a trans person. Like, let's look at Oscar winners for trans roles. Those are cis people, okay? And, like, Boys Don't Cry for me, she can have that Oscar. That was amazing, right? That story is really painful. She deserved that award. You know, Dallas Buyers Club, maybe not so much. You know, like, we're kind of past this point where we need to see men playing trans women. That is a problem. If you want to have trans characters and you're going to cast cis people in them, which I would say right now is not a great moment to do because we're not equal enough, but if you are going to do that, at least have the compassion to have a woman playing a woman and a man playing a man. You know what I'm saying? Like, why do you have men playing trans women? That really adds to this rhetoric that trans women are men, which is not true and doesn't help us. So, I feel like I understand why people.
I see how it is a complicated but not so complicated at the same time. Because, I mean, I don't have an opinion on this, obviously, but I do understand, like, it's like, okay, there's actors that are trans they should have the opportunity to play that because that is their experience.
Mm-hmm.
So why not give that opportunity? There's not that many anyways. So why not just give it to someone who's truly living that experience, who can embody that character?
Exactly. And I mean, something that I think
I understand that.
Yeah. And I think something that's really fascinating about the case of Emilia Perez specifically is Carla Sofia Gascon is an absolute force. Like, I'm obsessed with her. Girl, I hope you get the Oscar. Oh my God.
Because I have to watch the film. I haven't seen it yet. So.
I don't want to spoil something for you, but I will just say, people who have seen it or who know this will understand what I'm saying. For her to play the role that she plays and the breadth of the role that she plays is historical. It's phenomenal. No one has done this. And I think that, like, yeah, we're in a really hard time in history. Yeah. The trans community, we're all traumatized, you know, that's why it's hard. And I think it's also why when something like this comes out, we're on the defensive. Because we're like, what does this mean going forward? Does this mean that if this film gets really platformed, then now a bunch of other cis people are going to make films about our lives and maybe those people won't hire trans people? Like, that's a legitimate concern, right? And that's work that Hollywood needs to do, to step into that and say, we're not going to allow that. But do we trust that, given history? No, you know? So there is this worry that we're just never going to see ourselves reflected accurately and compassionately. And then sometimes when there is something that is more compassionate, in my view, we're still so afraid. We're still so hurt that we cannot see the compassion in it because there are other things that we just wouldn't necessarily say or do if we made it ourselves.
Yeah, no, that is a very, very important thought and point because, I think that example or that could apply to a lot of us filmmakers who feel like there's not enough representation or opportunities are equal. So the things that we're battling is, do you want representations and stories made in general versus having all those opportunities given? But what if the gatekeeping doesn't create the opportunities? Still, what is the best outcome, best case scenario would be, well, still there is stories being made. So there's still that. And I think that's kind of the critical thinking part where we're like, okay, well, we have to do better. And what does that mean? Hollywood has to do better. Like where I, from my opinion, I think we're in a very unusually strange shifting time in Hollywood. Because even what Hollywood means anymore, I don't know what that is. 10 years ago, 12 years ago, It has shifted, and now, and like I said, I'm not an expert by any means, so I don't want to, like, you know, say that. But my opinion is that the amount of acquiring stories and all that, paired with the business model of Hollywood at the current moment with the streamers, paired with like who actually can work in this costly medium and have access and proximity to the gatekeepers, because that's another thing. Like, you know, there is amazing stories all over America, internationally, but how many people, like, where is the hub now? Where is the proximity now? And then that lead up to the opportunities to pitch and then having access to pitch, then actually getting something cleared and then funded. They are just obstacles upon obstacles. And they were always like that. But now I feel like, and not to be like a Debbie Downer, but like it is a strange time. And I think I always go back to independent film. That's why independent film is a great avenue, because you're like, okay, well, you know, I'm still going to make important stories and at least whoever sees it for the sake of seeing it. But yes, reaching distribution, reaching more audiences and have more visibility. Yeah, I feel like I don't have an answer for that, Felix. And I think we're all like struggling to figure out our footing in the industry as producers and what that means. Because who is in charge? Is there in charge at all anymore? Is it just like, I don't know. That's a conversation that I don't know. How do we end this conversation? I mean, what are your thoughts? Like, what do you think is going to happen? As far as like, I mean, who do you think is in, how do we get representation and films made and make them accessible, how do we get through those gatekeepers? What do we do?
I feel like right now we're going to see a really big increase in the independent space. And I think that the independent space is a great place for marginalized voices to kind of, without restraint, start playing, you know? We're in a landscape where we're being constantly told, oh, these streamers, these CEOs, they don't want to take risks. Cool. I'll take the risk. I'll fund this project. And then you can see it on the festival circuit and you can buy it because you already know there's an audience. That's how it's going to work, right? Mm-hmm. People have been doing polls on Gen Z. Nobody wants these reboots. Nobody's interested in these reboots. A lot of these reboots are for people who don't watch TV. Like, a lot of these reboots are for the CEOs themselves who want to watch something from their youth. Like, no one wants this, you know? There's just so much, like, mismanagement of understanding how, like, money works and understanding how trends work. Like, Barbie, for me, was, like, such a hilarious moment. Like, one, absolutely obsessed with that movie. Great movie, loved it. So the takeaway then for the streamers was, cool, so we'll just buy anything that Mattel have and we can make a film out of it and you'll like it, right? No, dum-dum, that is not how that works, right? Why did that work? It works because going to the cinema was an event. It worked because you put so much money in your marketing campaign. It worked because Margot Robbie is an absolute genius, okay? Like, it's not, oh yeah, we really want to watch, like, you know, the Polly Pocket movie, which, like, okay, I'll probably watch the Polly Pocket movie, but you know what I mean? Like, after that, they have, like, a slate of 10 things.
It's like a car movie. They're also producing the car movie. I'm
like, come on. Cool. It's just...
I see what you're saying. It's kind of like the Barbie movie was, like, a trailblazer moment in the recent cinema experience because we haven't had them. That's why it was so, like... celebrated and well received, but now if we just copy that over again, it'll become redundant and then it'll lose its cachet and it won't be as interesting. And then, and that's exactly what's happening, right? Like the recopying, the yes, I agree. And I do think it's the older baby boomer at the helm. That are like, let's bring back, you know, Indiana Jones and let's do this version. Let's do that version. Like they did that with Twisters. They did that with a lot of movies. And which I think is great, you know. It was a great movie then. Why do we have to do a reboot? Why not, like, do something new? But that's the whole risk thing, you know.
But it's so funny because any amount of, like, I don't understand. It's like these people are experts, supposedly. I mean, you know, can people who've moved over from tech who actually don't know anything about art be experts? I don't know. But supposedly experts, right, in what they're selling and their business models, despite the fact that they're tanking, right? But, like, hello, let's have a little look at what's happened this year, okay? So you spent how much money on Folie à Deux? How much money, right? And then Terrifier 3 comes in and it's like, see you later. Let's look at that. Why did that succeed? Why did that succeed? It succeeded because from Terrifier 1 up to where it is now, it's built this fan base. I mean, horror in general is great at doing that. There's always this kind of niche fan base there. But, like, it's doing something different. It's, there's a character that has been created that people can gather around. And then there's also another, like, the anti-hero. There's, like, the heroine, and then there's also the clown, right? And we like both of these people. So there's the character development, but it's also the fact that it's, like, people don't want to see the same thing over and over. And I mean, there's also, people are split on Joker. I get that, but it's more than that.
That's,
you know,
a really contested debate on Joker. I actually was having this conversation with Drew recently. We're like, you know, I love Lady Gaga, Joaquin Phoenix, but there is so much like commentary in that film. And I'm just like, no, it's just, I refuse to accept that because, you know,
I haven't even seen it yet, but I love her, so I feel like I'm going to love it. I mean, but then that's the thing. Like, I feel like a lot of the time I'm not a film critic. You know what I mean? Like, I don't go to a film to pick the flaws in it. I go to the cinema for the reason I've always gone to the cinema, which is to have a good time. So anybody who follows my letterbox is like, what the heck? Because I'm like, 5 stars, I had a great time. And it's like the, you know, it's like some budget horror film that everyone's like, this is like 2 stars at best. And I'm like, yeah, but it was inventive. It told me something different. I laughed the whole way through or whatever, you know, like I don't measure films in this way where I'm like, oh, right, it has to tick all of these boxes of this film that I had in my brain before I sat down and watched this. Because I'm sitting down and watching the film that's in front of me. And I think that right now there's a lot of kind of like what passes for film criticism right now is bonkers to me. And Letterboxd is a really good example of that. I feel like as much as I am invested in, you know, social issues and politics, that cannot be the only measure that you use to critique art. And I actually think that it really flattens what art is and what art can be. You see, I'm going to say something else that people are going to disagree with, but like you see this a lot with Ryan Murphy, you know? Ryan Murphy is a genius. I'm sorry. Like the stuff that he does is gorgeous. It's amazing. Like, are there a few of his things where I'm like, that's not for me? Yeah, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to make my review. I dislike this person personally. That has nothing to do with art, you know? And I see people do that time and time again. Like their entire review is just, I don't like Ryan Murphy personally. And it's like, well, one, you haven't met him. And two, what about every other person who worked on this?
Yeah,
you're telling me that he did the cinematography, he wrote it, he also directed it, he also produced it, he also did the costuming? No.
On a project,
right? So like, series, you're just...
100 people. No, you're right. Final segment, future of entertainment.
I just
recently came across a clip of Ben Affleck talking about AI. I don't know, have you seen it?
I haven't. But I did watch that AI movie. You know, I was like, this is garbage. Hated it.
Okay, so you know, there's just so much right now this past year of AI. There's like so much, right? Like we've talked about it. You're in the mix with AI as far as you know. You're on top of that. But recently, I just came across this clip like literally this morning. And someone was asking, like, oh, what's going to happen with storytelling and AI is going to replace? Because, you know, jobs have been replaced. A lot of stuff has been automated recently in Hollywood. And I've actually used AI in stock footages for my pitch decks. I'm sorry, guys. I did because it's a cost factor. I'm an independent producer. I would love to hire someone for $5,000 a project. But at the moment, my budgets are not that great. So they're not that big. So I have had to use it. I don't feel like I'll be substituting AI for writers or directors or producers because I feel like there's a niche there. But Ben Affleck, as someone on this panel, and I don't know the panel, so I'll have to Google it, but there's a panel and there was a tech person talking about all this hoopla about AI in Hollywood. Should we be concerned? And then Ben Affleck said something like, well, AI can do whatever, but it doesn't have taste.
Mm-hmm.
Taste is, that's the IP. Like, and that's true.
Yeah.
So that was like, oh, in this conversation, almost a year and a half in, finally something that I think really cut through the noise. Taste.
Yeah.
Taste.
Yeah. And I mean, from the first moment I ever had any kind of mentorship or anything about this industry, taste is king, right? You know, that's what every executive is going to want to ask you as soon as you get into any kind of general. They're like, what are you watching? What do you know? Like, what do you like? How can I, you know, there's a lot of boxes that you get put into for that. But it's also just like, yeah. And I think further to your point, just like in terms of what AI can and can't do, I had a conversation actually with a VFX artist who was my Uber driver recently, and he was adamant that AI is just going to take over. And I was just like, as a storyteller, no, like AI can only regurgitate what it's been fed. We're literally talking about the fact that Gen Z want innovation. You know, we're also should be talking about the fact that Gen Z have the opportunity to make things for themselves at the drop of the hat. So why, if you're going to sell them something they can make themselves, they're not going to buy it because they can tailor it to themselves way easier. So like, you know, like, if people are able to make TikToks and then AI is doing what it's doing, everyone's going to start being able to make things like that. We're seeing it already, right? And that's great for creation. But in terms of like actual, like sellable, meaningful, like long form work, like you can never erase the human aspect of that. And I think it really speaks to like this like narrowness of a worldview. Like, why the hell would you want to like get rid of artists? You think you can make a computer an artist? That is absolutely absurd. Like, there's many jobs for sure that are going. And I think the thing is, this is going to hit like below the line way harder than it's ever going to hit anyone above the line. And that sucks, you know, because it's our crews who do so much work. They are the ones who are laboring for so many hours, like, you know, sometimes under terrible conditions, as we keep seeing from the studios, you know, like those are the jobs that are going to go. And those, that's thousands, millions of people who have families, who've been, who have knowledge of craft, who can make things quicker, better, stronger, you know?
Not to interrupt you, but because I share that sentiment, and I'm going to say that there's another article that came out last week or last 2 weeks ago by Justine Bateman called Hollywood is Dead. But then it's a controversial article too, but she makes one thing that I feel like was very hopeful and optimistic, that there is a bubble and a trend that will burst and stuff will emerge as well. So like, I mean, however people feel about her politically or personally, but because that's the thing, because we can also like, from a subjective point of view, like that can also like, just put that apart. I also believe that this will get saturated and all the celebrity content creators will, people will tap out.
Yep.
Just as Instagram has lost a lot of its power over time to TikTok, eventually things always have a timeline and a cycle that they follow. And I think that will bring us back to innovative storytelling, original storytelling. So in the meantime, I still think we should be creating independently. I think the goal is like, we need to reevaluate what the cinema experience is, what platforms are, how can Hollywood that may find themselves out of work stay working and creative, and maybe take some of the theater audience and bring it into other spaces. I don't know what that looks like. We've had another guest who's like into Web3, and she's like, I'm creating a platform where we own our own algorithm, not our own data. We own our own audience. Maybe that's a possibility. I don't know, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that we're going to end up in a situation where people are like, hey, this film was made completely without AI, and that's a USP. Like, I 100% think that that's what's going to happen. I think that right now, everybody is like, you can't get away from AI. It's on every search bar. It's Google. It's Instagram. It's everywhere. I didn't ask for this in my PDFs. I don't want it. Okay. Like, I'm not interested. If I want to seek out AI tools, which again, like you said, there are useful AI tools for people. Like, if I wanted to seek those out, I'd seek those out. I don't need to have the option for AI on every single app I ever go on. And I think people are already tired of that. And I think that these big companies that are betting big on AI are going to lose down the line. 100% I believe that. Something that's really been kind of boring and annoying, to be honest, with this, through the entire like strike process, through all this stuff, is this thing that like, it's dead, it's going, it's dead, and it's just been doom and gloom. And it's like, okay, well, instead of doing that, what can you create? What can you do right now to further your creation? Like, there's so many, dare I say, echo chambers of people just having a bad time. And it's like, I get that we are having a bad time, but also like, what can you do on your own to further your own art? Like, if Hollywood is dead, make another Hollywood. Like, you know, and I think part of the reason why it's like, since November 5th, like, all we've heard about from Hollywood is like, okay, so now we're going to have like 50 million Yellowstones. We want to appeal to, you know, the more conservative white middle America. And it's like, that is such a misunderstanding of what has happened here and what we need. And it makes me and many people kind of go, cool, well, we just won't work with the studios then, you know, and that's only going to make outside art queerer and more diverse and more interesting. And at some point they're going to be like, well, we have to buy this because this is what people actually want. And this is what people are actually watching. And it's not like, there's nothing. Sure, if you like Yellowstone, you like Yellowstone. I haven't watched it. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But nobody wants only Yellowstone on TV. That's crazy.
Yeah, I think the problem, I think we all can agree with, is that they're not listening to the audience. Mm-hmm. And they're not, it's like five people making decisions and buying the same stuff over and over again. And there's like so much talent, so many great scripts, so many great actors, screenwriters, directors, producers in this town and outside this town. There's enough material for all these streamers and these networks for us to have plenty of catalogs of beautiful storytelling. But it's like the five people, whoever those unnamed five people are the ones that are buying the stuff and making the same stuff over and over again. And here we are watching it. And I think the rebel in me is like, yeah, no, just go indie. Go make your own stuff. And like you said, just trailblaze ahead and do what Jeff Bezos did, you know? Bring the films to people. You know, like, if you can't get people to the theaters, give them, like, what was that? That's just, I feel like the success of Amazon was basically like, okay, you're not going to go out to the store. I'll give you the store so it's right there all the time in your face. So maybe that's something of the Web3 space, the app space. And we're there. Maybe another guest of mine this year talked about YouTube just being another place for films, possibly. I think if we could go in the ultra tier of YouTube where it's like a Vimeo type, but it's also all that, maybe that could be a place too. And because I already know content is, YouTube is growing infinitely, and web series and that, and that's where the success from TikTok social media goes to YouTube, and then that money is converted, and then you have these celebrity producers who then get these lead roles in Netflix specials and made for streamer movies, and then actors are like, but I've been in Hollywood and auditioning, and now I have this like person who just blew up during the pandemic in a movie. But can you really hate on them? That's not their fault. So the tech thing is, okay, build your data set, build your following. And that's like an added level of work and effort. Now I think all of us, because I hate social media, I'm sorry to say, but yeah, that's one of the things we have to do because we're now plugged into that. And if we want to get audiences sooner and have them follow our journey into our films or careers, then yeah, we have to unfortunately put that effort into building an audience. And that's why they're always like, well, you know, promote yourself, promote this, how many followers do you have, which is really hard for writers and producers because we're not, you know, TikTok influencers and stuff. That's not what we do.
Like, I've been to enough writers mixers to know that like we're all a bunch of like weird nerds. Like the best kind of weird nerds, but like, no, that doesn't always translate to having the best social media presence. That usually, no, you know, translates to being the best at Dungeons and Dragons and also writing,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah,
it's just a completely different landscape.
Hey man, nerds rule the world. That's just the, yes, that's just the way it is. That's always been the case. People just don't want to say it out loud.
I'm just, that's saying, why they always used to shove us in lockers at school, right?
I'm just saying. Okay, yeah, because nerds, they don't peak in high school, right? Like, so it's, yeah, like it's, yeah, they have a longer journey to come to fruition and develop their beautiful creativity and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to close out. We have a few questions in our final segment. Kind of went over, Felix, and thank you, Drew, for being so cool. Do you see yourself exploring other forms of storytelling?
Absolutely. I want to write a musical for the stage at some point. I absolutely want to be, like, the kind of collaborative process involved in theater making is a lot, like, more collaborative than film often is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, weirdly, like, the collaboration aspect is one of the, is, well, maybe not weirdly, but it's one of my favorite things about, like, being on a set. But I think what made me fall in love with it was I was like, oh, this is just like living on a protest site. Like, it's a bunch of people with a shared goal who are trying to kind of like scrappily put out a bunch of fires and make something beautiful happen. Like, that's, it's the same kind of mindset. And so I think this is also a reason why I'm in the independent film space, because I've spoken to many people who've worked, you know, in the kind of more commercial side of things. And I'm not saying I'm not interested in that, but it's a very different methodology.
Yeah.
And again, like, just to go back to the Q&A I was at last night, listening to a bunch of European filmmakers talking about their process and hearing how collaborative that is really stood out to me. You know, in Europe, the arts are funded in a way that they're not funded over here. Wow. And so we have to bank on a commercial kind of success, and we also have to move at a pace, and we also have to, like, you know, like, it's not that there aren't investors and other things involved, but there's like what would it be like if we could spend as much time as we really truly needed inside of a project, developing that project with as many people involved in the process, composers, like set designers, costume designers, like talent, etc. If we could form a bubble and really work together as a team on that, think how richer all of our narratives would be.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't have that here as much.
No, there's just not an appreciation for the arts in America at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet during the pandemic / lockdown or whatever, what was everybody doing? They were watching television, yeah. They were watching Netflix. And who are those people? The writers, the ones on strike, the ones who don't get paid enough. So I really feel like that's like the thing, like we need to appreciate the arts. They serve a very important part in society and community. And that respect needs to be given to writers and all creators and crew. And it's unfortunate because there's a lot of money being made.
Yeah.
And there's no reason it can't, we all like can't prosper from that. Except
it's
greed. That's
it's
what
greed.
It is.
And those
lack
salaries.
Of respect for the arts. Lack of, I always tell people when you look down upon like someone who's aspiring to be a filmmaker, a writer, a sound engineer or whatever, or a director, like, think, get rid of your television, get rid of your radio, don't go to the movies, because all the people that you, when you come home from work or when you need to like, you know, just chill and do something, like all the artists, museum, all these things that provide these resources and these wonderful experiences to either escape, relate, and heal and feel are created by creators, you know, creatives. And here you are like looking down at that, and then the pandemic happens and you're like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is important. But it's not. It's not, just like teachers are not respected, I think, in this country. Like they're doing the most important job. Mm-hmm. You know, they're educating children and yet they're not paid enough. I feel the same way about like, you know, artists, because we are providing this resource for people. Multi-generational animations for families to get together during the holidays. It's playing in the background. These are important jobs. Yes, we're not saving lives, which are very important. I love my doctors. I love engineers. I love humanitarians, like a lot of love for humanitarians and social workers. But these are also important jobs. And I think all of us have those unique gifts that are given to us as individuals. And I just feel like what I've learned since the pandemic to now is like, we just need to bring back the respect and the appreciation for artists and creatives, and then bring equity in the pay, because there's no reason, there's a lot of profit being made from projects.
And I mean, I think, well, like art is what makes culture, art's what moves culture forward. Like that's why to me art can be activism. Like culture moves faster than policy, we know that. And I would say that there are artists who are saving lives, you know, and that's not always just about representation, but it's also just, it's about possibility models, and it's about seeing things outside of ourselves, learning about other people. There's so many, like, even like so many documentaries that teach us about parts of the world, parts of other people's culture that you would never, especially if you're an American, this country's huge. It's very expensive to leave it. It's, you know, it's expensive to travel it, right? So there's lots of people who are not learning about any culture outside of their backyard. Film and TV has the ability to bring you straight into another person's life. That is world changing. That changes everything.
Education, awareness, it brings the world closer and unifies us through the stories. And yes, I do believe it. And yeah, like I said, I always say that, like when I say I champion the artist and storyteller, doesn't mean that I don't champion other fields, because I do. I think everybody's role on this planet, it's important. We all have a unique gift to contribute to society. But I feel like, someone in the industry, I feel like, you know, there's no reason for a lot of us to be struggling in any way, especially in the beginning where there's just so much money being made, you know, and that's the question. How do we respond to hate? Is there an antidote?
Okay, I think there's a few things. So obviously, we're kind of up against it. There's a lot of stuff happening. We don't know what the next few years are going to look like. I really think what's important is to be finding community with one another. And I think the other thing that we really need to do is we need to put aside our differences within circles where we are mostly aligned. On the side of hatred, those people do not care where they're misaligned. they just care that they hate the same people. So they build networks extremely well, because it's much easier to build a network on what you don't like and what you hate than it is to build a network on what you appreciate. The reason why, like, if you want to go into like left and right, I guess, like the reason why the left is so terrible at building coalitions is because we hate one another. We pick each other apart. Even within like communities where we are like super aligned, there's so much trauma from a lot of these, because a lot of people on the left are marginalized. There's so much trauma that we haven't had the chance to like breathe out or like in any way work through, that it's so much easier for us to be like activated by one another and spend time on that than to be like, okay, let me push that aside and let me see this bigger problem that we all need to coalesce together and defeat. Like, that's really hard, but that's what we need to do. I don't know how to get people's nervous systems to a place where they're able to do that work, especially under these circumstances. It's extremely challenging, but that's the work. That's the work that we all need to be committed to. And I say that to myself as well. Like, this is extremely activating time. Like, this is also like the only US election I've ever lived through, and it's horrific. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm having the worst time, you know?
Yeah.
But in that, it's like, okay, what can I do? Who are my people? Yeah. And let me tell you, there is nothing like a moment like this to teach you who your people are and who they aren't.
Oh, goodness.
You know?
It's like a strange filtering process, litmus test of all kinds. Oh, you said it. Okay, last question. And we'll conclude. And I'm sure a reflective question. What does home feel like?
Home. Okay, well, that's interesting, because it's a few different things. So, in terms of like place, home is always going to be Scotland. There's this weird calling to the land, I feel like, when you are someone who is born and lived in Scotland, like, and something very cultural that you hold on to that is different. Like, I read something on Reddit that was talking about how Scottish people don't really care what your blood is. Like, we care how much time you've spent in Scotland. We care how much you know the land. We care how close you are to tradition. I don't think that's 100% across the board, because I've met some amazing Americans who are deeply entrenched in our traditions and keeping them alive in a way that many Scottish people aren't, you know? So I think it's more complicated than that. But that's one kind of home for me. And the other kind of home is like a space where, again, your nervous system is calm, and a space where you can say things that are difficult and you know that no one's going to drag you over the coals. Like a space where like hard conversations are held within a seat of like mutual understanding. You know, I'm not going to dispose of you. I feel like there's so much disposability politics because social media has really amplified cancellation culture. And I don't mean that in terms of like people who have actual power, because we know that cancellation doesn't work there. Cancellation culture just affects small minority communities, and we just dispose of one another, like a witch trial. I see this happen all the time. Like, home is a place where that isn't happening. It's not on the table. You know that whoever you're speaking to is going to love you regardless of whether you disagree. That's what home is.
Love that, Felix. This was a very intensive, illuminating, insightful, and wonderful conversation with you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming onto our podcast and sharing sharing all this amazing information. I know we didn't get to everything. I am going to put all your links to your films and how people can connect with you on the website. And we are going to be following your journey all the way up to Northern California.
Hey.
And I can't look forward to watching your films, Felix. Thank you so much.
Of course, anytime. And my DMs are always open. If there are trans people out there who just need someone to talk to, I'm there anytime.
Oh, thank you. That's really sweet. We will add all that information. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed the Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franceblatt. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah. Thanks for listening.